his own pocket, but when you have the $100, will they not jingle? They will, you see. If not in your pocket, in somebody, your friend's pocket, they will jingle. So are you not here, Paul, making the transition from the idea to reality? Yes, you are. Meaning, may not be an actual particular man, but for all, are there not the possibilities? So what is knowledge? What the knowledge of? Knowledge is nothing but the knowledge of the a priori element, which is the very condition of all possible experience. Of all possible, not any actual experience, he doesn't say that, but of all possible experience. That all knowledge is possible only when certain a priori elements are granted. If you do not have any knowledge about the three-sided rectilinear figure as the definition of knowledge, you can never have that knowledge by mere observation experiment of a triangular piece of land. It will not come in your head. Or if your mere observation and experiment, you will not have this, any vice versa. So that is both of the. So what is he doing? He is saying that the a priori element which is given by reason is the very condition, mark that word condition, is the very condition of all possible knowledge. Another word to come is of all possible knowledge. So all possible knowledge, in future, in today, in past, whatever you go with, is possible only on accepting certain conditions given by our reasoning. So reasoning is fundamental, most fundamental. And reasoning is by the mind. So understanding giveth laws to the nature. Understanding giveth laws to the nature. So understanding doesn't approach nature, you see, in order to dictate nature. No, understanding approaches nature in order to become wise, wiser. You understand that understanding, yes, my mind goes to nature. For what purpose? Am I going dictating nature? Formulating nature? No, nature is independent of you, but it will be taught. Understanding knows that it must be taught by nature. Whether he is right or wrong, it must be understood by observation and experiment. So observation and experiment are the criteria of what you think. Your conception in the hand must be observable, must be possible of being experimented upon, and therefore there will be all possible knowledge. So the possibility of knowledge depends upon the possibility of the conditions which we have. The reality, the possibility of reality depends upon the possibility of, you see, of the ideas in your head. So you make a transition from the ideas to the possible experience. This is constitutes idealism, because that reality will be located in time and dated in space. And if it is so, then it is not, everything is not located in space. Why is it not? Because either they lack the laws of understanding. The laws of understanding, the principles of understanding. What are these principles of understanding? He says, there are 12 principles of understanding. I don't go into the details, I leave it to the teachers of philosophy. There are 12 principles of understanding. This is the a priori element. Whatever is given to you in space and time is the sensible element. Whatever is given to you in by way of understanding is the a priori element, analytic element given to you by reason. So he calls it as the principles of understanding or reason. They are 12 in number, corresponding to 4 headings: the quantity, the quality, you see, then the affirmation or negation, causation, and afterwards as the relation. Relation, causation, then what is it? Relation, causation, quantity and quality. Under these 4 headings you get 3, and 4 into 3, that is 12. These are the 12 windows of a citadel. How many windows I don't know this hall has, but if it has got 12 windows, it will be Kantian image. That we get knowledge through these 12 doors. You shall say that it is one man or many men. You shall say that it is affirmative or negative. You say that it is the cause or the effect, and as the relation of husband and wife, or of wife and husband, and etc. in several ways that the relations can be thought of, causation can be thought of, or quality and quantity can be thought of in all these 12 different ways. So these 12 different ways are the principles of understanding. This is the a priori element, and the sensible data, the sense material, the raw material, comes through these 12 doors. And then it is located in space and time. So everything that is sensible, everything that comes on account of observation and experiment, must come through one of these windows, or one or more of these windows. It is, or may come with 12 windows. Nobody is about, there are no doors, but there are windows only in that hall. In that citadel of knowledge, there are only 12 windows and no doors. So knowledge must come through these windows, just as a man who comes late, comes not by the front door but the hind door, or jumps through the window. Immediately, knowledge must jump into the hall and one of the 12 windows. This is known as the categories of understanding. And these categories of understanding receives, welcomes the knowledge coming from outside. Outside from what? Now that is the problem. You will say from space and time. But what is there? Space and time doesn't produce. Out of space from a camel comes. Has a camel come here? I don't think. An elephant comes. He doesn't. But actually if a camel comes, he comes from outside. So there is a camel outside. There is an elephant outside. Not in my head or in my language. If he is there, then the camel comes. That is, the camel is there outside in space, not here in this space of the hall, not in at this moment, but he is there, and he comes inside, supposing. Or some picture of it, or some image of it, some description of it, that knowledge of the description of that camel comes in. But the camel must be there. Or the elephant is there and no picture of camel will be there, no description of camel will be there. Similarly, whatever comes out of sense, you see, from it must come from outside. That is, the things from which spring up the raw material of sense must come from outside. And therefore it locates outside, outside this hall, outside the citadel of knowledge, what is technically known as the things in themselves. The camel is a thing in itself. The elephant is another thing in itself, and so on. There are myriads of things in themselves. So from the things in themselves, which are there, outside me, outside my this space, outside my sensations, outside my brain, outside my reasoning, about both of them, the things are there. And from them come the sensations. I shall put now the things in a reverse manner. You see, I have started from reasoning. I have made the start from sense, and then come to space and time, then come afterwards to things in themselves. I shall reverse this thing and say once again that, and that is the whole problem of the critique of pure reason. Thing there, he starts. And that is what is known as the phenomenal knowledge. Phenomenal knowledge. There are things in themselves, mountains, rivers, elephants, camels, horses, etc., etc., etc. Things in themselves. There are first. And then sensations come from them. And they enter through these windows, through these principles of understanding. And they catch the space and time. They are dated and located, and then they make an appeal finally to the mind of man. So knowledge arises. Knowledge is nothing but the traversing of this raw material of sensations coming from the things in themselves through the windows, 12 windows of the citadel of knowledge, and are being located in space and time and making a final appeal to the self, which he say by a very big word, unity of apperception. Unity of apperception. Don't be afraid of these long, big words, boulders. They are boulders in words. You see, you cut them and say, call it self. That's all. Call it mind. So I know this object because this is a thing in itself, and sensations come from this and then pass through the categories of understanding. Make and pass further through space and time, and finally make an appearance. This is all you can say is a phenomenal knowledge. You see. Venus, for example, the star Venus, Something comes from that, a ray of light, suppose. And that ray of light passes to my eyes, to these senses. And it is one ray of light or 100 rays of light, they come. They pass to my, the categories of understanding. Oh, it is there. It is there at such a great distance. That star is there. I have located. And now it is there. And then who is knowing this? It is I. So ultimately, it is I who understand. So he makes all knowledge about things depending upon the I. You see. So in this way also, he is an idealist. In this way also, he is an idealist. Because he makes mind as responsible for all knowledge. Mind as responsible, and it is in mind, it is in reason that ideas are produced. I have an idea. I know that there is an object like Venus because the raw material in the form of sensations coming from that thing in itself comes through my understanding and is located in space and time and then makes a final appeal to us. This is all the explanation which you find in the Critique of Pure Reason, nothing more than that. So what is in Critique of what is contained in the first book of Kant, you will say it is nothing but an explanation of how knowledge arises. How knowledge arises? He gives an explanation of all our sensible knowledge, that it is this way that knowledge arises, that it is nothing but a counterpart. What is that Venus then? Have I known the entire Venus? He says, I don't know. I don't know whether I have known the entire Venus or not. But whatever I have known belongs to that star. Meaning I have captured that much knowledge which my mind has got. I know that much which I can have through these apparatus, you see, of space and time and understanding. That is all. I have not given you I have omitted it from what is known as the schemata. Schemata means imagination, an imaginary picture. But by the way, I may just tell you that you know Venus, for example, because it is a bright object and a ray of light is shown. At a distance, for example, you see some object. And then you do here and here and you ask your friend and he says, what is this object? What is this object? You are puzzled. And then you say, oh, a man is coming. I say, no, it is not a man. I think it is a stump of a tree. And there is a riddle. Whether it is a stump of a tree which I am seeing or whether it is actually a man I am seeing, I do not know. Then I imagine it. That imagination becomes the schemata. You see, if the object is not known thoroughly, then what will you say? You imagine something. And then, oh, I think that he is moving his hand. That is a man. The stump of tree will not move in that manner. So it is what is known as knowledge coming through schemata. First, imagination works upon it. It is as if, according to Indian philosophy, it is an inarticulate knowledge. Inarticulate means not distinct and clear as yet. Inarticulate knowledge. It is as yet on the stage of imagination. I imagine that he is a man. I imagine that it is only a trunk of a tree, and then in course of time it becomes clearer. No, I am sure that he is man. Why? Because it has now passed through my understanding, the principles of understanding. And then, of course, I can say it is man, not a trunk of tree. I was wrong in thinking that it was trunk of tree. So, a distant object, for example, sends no doubt several messages to us. These messages are not understood by me first. They are imagined. They are codified. I encode them. And then I say that it is this, it is this, it is this, etc. So all knowledge is nothing but the ascertainment of, you can say, through imagination, through the understanding, and through space of time, and making a final appeal to the unity of a perception. What then it is that? It is that which you already may, it is that which you have wished to know. Your mind has captured that much only and not further. So there is in that thing in itself, there are two parts. which you have known and which you have not known. Which you have known you call knowledge, but what you have not known, what will you call it? It is, you can say, unknowable, or better still, unthinkable. That which remains as a surd, S-U-R-D, that which remains as a residuum of knowledge, that which is not, you can say, unknowable or unthinkable, that is what is known as, is labeled as agnostic element in Kant. That is what is known as the agnostic element in Kant. Kant is an agnostic. Kant is agnostic. Gnostic so far as the knowledge is certain, agnostic so far as the unthinkable and unknowable. What lies beyond these things in itself, he does not know. Therefore, he is honest in saying that there is an element of agnosticism also. Kant is an agnostic because he does not know the entire extent of thing in itself. He knows a part of it, and to that he calls that it is knowledge. So knowledge and no knowledge go together, hand in hand in Kant. He is not dogmatic in saying that I have known the full extent a thing in itself. He is saying this much part of the thing in itself I have known, and I call it knowledge. Now who gives this? I have known that much part of the thing which my mind has done it. Meaning that much part which you know is the counterpart, is the analogue, the prototype of your mind. It is nothing but a reflection on your mind. Have you not gone here from idea to reality? From the idea in your mind to reality. It is idealism, you see. Kant is one of the greatest idealists in spite of himself. He has attacked on idealism, and he has himself become a great idealism in the fact that the thing which he knows is nothing but the counterpart of what he knows. So knowledge is nothing but the bringing together of mind from the one side and the sense from the other side. He has solved the problem of empiricists and rationalists by bringing them together, you see. And this is the whole account of his phenomenology in the Critique of Pure Reason. The first book is finished, you see, which he wrote in April. The next is, he himself, because there is an agnostic element, and he says, there is an agnostic element with no doubt in things, but what about God? What about the freedom of the soul? What about immortality? Do I know anything about it? Then say, yes, I know something about it, because God is omniscient, God is omnipotent, etc. Freedom of the soul? Freedom of the soul is doubtful because man may be partially free. He, as in say, ethics and in religion, he may be absolutely bound by the sensible world, and or he may be free totally as God is free. So there is doubt still in his mind whether there is freedom or not. You see, whether determinism is true or indeterminism is true, he is doubtful. And about immortality, nobody has gone and returned from death. Nobody has died and returned from death. So I can't say anything about whether man is immortal or not, whether it is personal immortality, impersonal immortality. He cannot say anything about it. So that part, namely this, God, freedom and immortality, these are problems which he doesn't know at all. There is no sensibility, there is no sense element in it, and only you can say that I have got certain ideas about these things. But rationalist, the a priori judgment, that alone does not give us knowledge. Therefore he says, where is the impression about it? Hume is the last word. Hume in philosophy will be the last word, you say. Show me an impression of which it is a copy. I have got an idea of immortality, no doubt, but what is corresponding to it? Is there anything? And Kant says, as there is no impression corresponding to it, it is nothing but moonshine. So he is not dogmatic. He says, there is an element of agnosticism. I do not know what is meant by God, what is meant by freedom of the soul, and what is meant by the immortality of the soul. Then reason cannot probe into it. It is impossible. They are unknowable things, unthinkable, he says. Then should I be satisfied with this critique of pure reason only? Then he thinks and says, no. He corrects himself by saying, now I shall give up reason and come to faith. Let me now make room for faith, that he says. wonderful it is. Just see a great man corrects himself several times. It doesn't mean that all is human, no doubt, but correction of human is very difficult. Pasteur corrected his pasteur, as you know, pasteurized milk, not plasterized milk. Here we get plasterized milk. In countries other than India, we get pasteurized milk. Here we get plastered milk. You see, bottled milk in which there are 90% bacteria and 10% pure milk. And if you put it in refrigerator, then they will be all alive again. Is it not? Even after several months, they will be pasteurized also, and they will be living. But in other countries, there is not a single bacteria in the milk, and the milk is always pure. Whether you keep it inside or outside the refrigerator, it is pure. Here it is plasterized, not pasteurized. But Pasteur corrected his own theory several times. As if I'm not wrong, I shall say about 17 times he corrected his mistakes. About 17 times. A great man is never afraid, never feels the shame of correcting himself. Kant says, I have made a mistake, that reason will give us everything. No. There are certain certs which remain outside the boundary of reason. And what are they? These three problems: God, freedom and immortality. They are outside the reason. Reason cannot touch them. Reason cannot approach them. There is no sensible element. So how can we say that we have knowledge about it? We cannot say. Then he says, I desert this reason and I approach faith. Let me now make room for faith. Wonderful. Let me now make room for faith. You see, by dismissing his reason, and he brings in faith. And that gives us a second group, namely a practical reason. Of his practical reason. This was the theoretical reason. He gave the knowledge of the phenomenal world, that which changes from moment to moment, that which is observable, and about which we can make experiments, and about which we can think. But there is neither thinking possible nor sensible element possible in these three problems: God, freedom and immortality. Therefore I shall have no faith. And what did he say? The starry sky above, you see, and the heart within, that's all. Is there any reason required? None at all. With conscience within and the starry sky above, I have got a faith that these two will enable me to solve the problems of God, freedom and immortality. And he says that there is freedom, there is immortality, and above them God is responsible for this freedom given to man, and from the immortality it assures for man. So all these three become possible for him so far, you see, in his practical reason, critique of practical reason. Does he stop there? What do we gain by saying that God is eternal or omniscient or omnipotent? What do we gain? What do we gain by saying that man becomes immortal even after death? Or what do we gain that man is saying by freedom? He is free to do evil, he is free to do good, he is free to be benevolent to others, he is free to be malevolent to others. Is that the freedom? There must be freedom for the good, and there must be restraint for the bad. He has got these problems. Everywhere there is antagonism. What he thinks, there is something which comes, oh no, this is not final, this is not final. He thinks of immortality. Do I taste it in this very life? And when I am dead, there is nobody to say whether I am mortal or immortal. There is God. Do you see actually God before you? That you say, can you handle him? Can you touch him? Can you see him? I do not find it. There is no sensible element. So why should I be so... You are dogmatic about that God, freedom and immortality exist at all. So he does not believe in the practical reason also. He goes to the third book, namely the critique of judgment. There he finds, and wonderful discoveries he makes by his own experience. Go to a the river Ganges, for example, in Alaba. When she is in floods, not otherwise. When she is floods, then you will find, oh, if you have seen it, I have seen it, and I have got an experience of one who has not gone there or seen a big expanse of then he cannot have this idea. At least have an imagination. The Atlantic Mahasagar, for example, for 8,000 miles, what may be? Nothing but water and water and water alone. Similarly, Matthew has said, there is nothing but sand and sand and sand and sand in this. These are the expressions. So, if you see sand and sand and sand and sand, are you not? If you see light and light and light everywhere, you are surprised. If a man has not got that, he is an animal. I should say, he is not a man but an animal standing on two legs, nothing more. If a man cannot have any idea of the vastness of space, if a man cannot have an idea of the vastness of water, of the vastness of the sky, of the blueness of the sky, or of his own conscience, or of his thinking processes, then he is not a man, you see. He is what? Vipada Pashu, that is. There are Chatushpada Pashus, and here is his Vipada Pashu. So Kant is leading us towards that, namely the beauty and the sublimity in nature. If you pluck a flower from a tree, you are hard-hearted. If you allow it to be there and dance with joy, with the coming and the going of the air, then you have sympathy with that flower. You can understand the beauty of that flower. You can believe sublimity of nature. So beauty and sublimity are to be discerned by a beautiful and a sublime soul, not otherwise. The beautiful and the sublime in nature can be understood only when your soul is beautiful and sublime. You can be generous to others, you can appreciate the generosity of others. If you are stingy and miserly, you cannot appreciate the generosity of others. You cannot understand what the Sidney Carton meant when he sacrificed his life for a beloved. Love stronger at death. You cannot understand that unless you sacrifice a part of your wealth, at least a 10 paisa, to a beggar on the station. But if you cannot spare, and if you find a 100 rupee note, give it. Give it to the beggar. If it is his fate that instead of finding 10 naya paisa, you have come across in your fingers a 10 rupee note or 100 rupee, give it freely to the beggar. There are certain persons, I am not just inventing things, I have seen such persons. I have heard from a friend of mine that a beautiful shawl costing about more than 100 rupees, he was given and as a present to him for his wisdom, etc. He was coming in a tonga and he saw a beggar and he threw it off. There is that. Just see, he has, as your poet, Nira, he has done it. Yes. So I am not inventing things. You see, you are part of your praise. Just a dying soldier, gasping for water, and when a cup of water, he saw another man. His need is greater than mine, and he gave that cup to him. Just see, unless a man is strong. I said to a young man, why don't you have a car? And he replied to me, then my car will not be with me. People will ask, why don't you give it to us? You see, he said to me, I felt very, very sorry. You have not been generous enough. You ask for another man's car always, and you don't wish to have your own car because other persons may ask of you. How stingy, how miserly you are. You are to die one day, and with this, I pitied him. Nothing. I didn't say to him, but I pitied him. Gone is the man. How can he appreciate sublimity and beauty in nature? He cannot. Just as a color-blind man cannot appreciate the presence of a color, similarly, man who is not generous, who is not sublime, beautiful in soul, cannot appreciate beauty and sublimity. Can't appreciate beauty and sublimity. And therefore, he has done that, beyond giving a lip service to the existence of God, freedom and immortality, let us be mortal in this very life. Let us be free in this whole very life. Let my heart not keep, it should be on the palm. It should not go into the buttocks of the intestines, my heart. If I am free to all, generous to all, and if I am don't conceal any deceit in my mind, then of course all are friends to me. No enmity. Conquer your jealousy. Conquer your by loving. Conquer your fear conquer your strangeness and enmity by love, and you will find all people loving you, and you love them all. You will find God there. God is not different from nature. God is not different from yourself. You see, God is there wherever you see. It is the last portion of Kant. Thank you, gentlemen.
So that day, friends, I express my sense of deep gratitude to Professor Date for giving such a lucid and highly understandable lecture on the philosophy of one of the greatest philosophers that the world has seen, namely Immanuel Kant. And by my further remarks, I will not like to disturb the thoughts which have been excited in you by Professor Date's lecture. So I once again thank you all, and we meet again tomorrow at 8:15 for the next lecture by Professor Date. Professor Date and friends, I feel it a privilege to welcome Professor Date and you all for the fifth day in the series of the lectures being delivered by Professor Date. I hope you have by now established a rapport with Professor Date's his address, and they must have felt, those who have established a rapport, that they are not only intellectually satisfying, but they also cater to the satisfaction of the hunger of the soul. So we are, I think, having an opportunity of our life when we are listening to the lectures by Professor Date. So I request you all to be present throughout the series in order to gain in every manner by those lectures. I now request Professor Date to deliver his lecture.
Professor Sharma, ladies and gentlemen, today I intend to finish the philosophers from the West, and from tomorrow, that is from Sunday, I shall take up Indian philosophers and philosophical systems. Today, in the course of my lecture, I shall discuss the philosophy, the main key points, about main key points in the philosophies of Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, Bradley, Bosanque, Pringle, Patterson, Green and Royce. Some 7 or 8 philosophers I shall discuss. Fichte, Schelling and Hegel, they can be bracketed together, with some difference, no doubt, between one and the others. If you remember 3 words, ethical idealism, aesthetic idealism, and logical idealism, then you understand the contribution of Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. Or if you remember 3 words, namely the subjective idealism, objective idealism, and absolute idealism, even then you know the philosophies of Fichte, Schelling and Hegel. So subjective idealism or the ethical idealism of Fichte, as you can say the objective idealism and the aesthetic idealism of Schelling, And the logical idealism or the absolute idealism of Hegel, all these go hand in hand. Hegel, as a matter of fact, is not much different from Fichte and Schelling. I do not know myself whether Fichte and Schelling are post-Kantian or pre-Hegelian, because I find elements in both of them, elements drawn from Kant and elements which are common with Hegel, Hegelian philosophy. So they can be considered as post-Kantian or pre-Hegelian. In fact, as we have seen from our way from Thales onwards, the main chief characteristic of Western philosophy is that it is genetic in character. That one philosophy holds its existence from its preceding philosophy, and gives something to its following, to its philosophy which follows after it. So one philosophy comes out of another philosophy. That is the chief characteristic of Western philosophy as a whole. This we shall not find in the philosophy of the East or Indian philosophy. You see, you shall find it for yourself that my observation regarding this, in the difference between Indian philosophy, is true after we come to Indian, the treatment of Indian philosophies. So as I say, Fichte and Schelling, they owe much to Kant, as well as they prepare the ground for the Hegelian philosophy. Fichte starts, no doubt, with the Kantian presuppositions, namely that the thing in itself is a prototype of the unity of our perception. And in this respect, we say that Kant is an idealist, that he is making the transition from idea to reality, or vice versa, from reality to idea. It is exactly this which Hegel also has in common when he says that the rational is real and the real is irrational. We must understand what the meaning of this, of course. When Kant says that the thing in itself is a prototype or a counterpart of the unity of our perception, why should there be an agnostic element in Kant? It means that the entire thing in itself is not copied by the unity of a perception. The unity of a perception, I shall use the word self, the self does not understand the entirety of the thing in itself. It only knows only a part. Otherwise, it will not be thing in itself. It will be an object of perception. The thing is not perceived totally in its entirety. It leaves some portion which is not perceived, meaning there is some incapacity involved in the conception of the self. And there is some overflow of the material in the thing in itself. Some part is known and some part is remain concealed. This happens, no doubt, in all fields of knowledge. You know something, but there is something which is hidden. Even in astronomy, you find that when all the planets were discovered, there were certain disturbances beyond Neptune. Neptune was discovered, and there were certain disturbances in light, etc. And beyond Neptune, there must be something. And they found Uranus. And then again, they found everything was not discovered by astronomers, and they found Pluto. So just as the discovery of one thing is necessitated by the previous things, similarly it was Fichte and Schelling tried to find out something which was wanting in Kant, and they found something which was fulfilled afterwards by Hegel. So every philosopher in Western philosophy comes as a sort of fulfillment of the dreams of his predecessor. Every stage in the Western philosophy is a product as well as a prophecy. The prophecy of Hegel, the Hegelian philosophy, is nothing but based upon what Fichte and Schelling have said. So Fichte, Schelling and Hegel, they can be bracketed together. And I shall tell something about these three at one, in the same breath. Fix the stars with the by inverting the content position and saying that I can know that much only which is contained in the thing in itself. Meaning thereby that my reason will only show that much which is contained, which is comprehended by, which is by from the material of thing in itself. The others I do not know. So, Fichte doesn't admit so much as a Kant that there is an element of agnosticism, but he takes notes of what is knowable and he leaves what is unknowable. Kant admits there is an element of unknowability, unthinkability in the thing in itself, but Fichte will not do that. Fichte will just invert the position and say that there is a creative energy in the self, and I can create that much which I can know, or I can know that much which I can create. The self has a creative force. There is nothing extra mental, so that there exists nothing outside the mind. It is the mind which creates it by the laws. But these are not laws of, you can say, of reason. They are the laws of intelligence. And these laws of intelligence go to the end, carry the man towards knowing the thing. So all of our knowledge is nothing but the knowledge of the thing in terms of, again, the self. The self knows, meaning the self knows what it has in its own mind. The self does not know anything beyond the self. The self knows what is contained in the self. There is some potentiality in the self, and it knows that. When it gives expression to what it has in itself, it is what is known as the not-self, you see. So, the self creates the not-self. This is the Fichtean philosophy. How does it create? Why does it create? Because there is a creative force contained in the self, and the self creates a not-self. The self does not know, as a matter of fact, anything beyond. There was not bifurcation between the self and the not-self. The not-self was not given to you as something to be known, but it is that which the self creates out of itself and knows it. So, this you can say, the self exists by itself, but it creates by its own creative faculty the not-self. So it knows the not-self. What does it know, the not-self? The not-self is not a not-self, but is a part of the self. And therefore there is nothing extra-mental at all, according to Fichte. Take the example of society. Man comes in. He does not know what is the society. He learns in course of time that something is there against me, opposite to me. I want to be a member of that. For example, you do not know what you want to do. Then you struggle hard. You see, you find that the members of the society in which you are nothing but the part and parcel of yourself, are nothing but the bone of bones and the flesh of flesh. They are the same persons, and you are struggling against them. That is, you are putting in ethical effort. You are just trying to adjust yourself with your social members and with the members of an organized state. Otherwise, in the first place, it may be an obstacle. Fichte found nature as an obstacle, you see, as an obstacle which hinders. But that hindrance is to be removed, and therefore there is a process which is known as the ethical process. There is a struggle, that there is a will, my will, and there is a will of another man. That another man is not an obstacle to me, it has to be converted into a friendly ally. In the first place I find that it is an enemy. It is some stranger. It is an alien force that counteracts my force. But it is not in course of time you learn that it has to be removed. And it will be removed in course of time. So my not-self is nothing but an alien element in my knowledge, but it is a friendly element in my knowledge. And I get reconciled. I get synthesized with that not-self. So that there is a thesis, an unconscious movement of the self. And then it becomes, there is a struggle which makes you friendly with the not-self which you yourself have created. So the antithesis, as it is called, which goes opposite to you, you reconcile yourself, and then both are reconciled in a third, namely the absolute mind.